This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhaib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There's certainly less political pressure on a technocratic government than there is on a political government. And hopefully they'll be more willing to take risks than politicians would be able to. But this is not Tunisia's first technocratic government. They've tried this in the past. And we've seen that just because it's a technocratic government, they're not guaranteed to perform better than a government made up of political figures.
That's Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at Carnegie's Middle East program on the new Tunisia's cabinet of technocrats without political affiliation. Details coming up also. Western African leaders have decided to keep sanctions to pressure the military junta in Mali to speed up its transition to civilian rule. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, we start with our top story. West African leaders decided today to keep sanctions in place against Mali to pressure the military junta to transition to a civilian government faster than it has proposed. Their virtual meeting reflects the junta's proposals after first vowing to turn over power quickly to run the country for 2 to 3 years. The ECOWAS regional grouping, which imposed sanctions and cut off borders the day after the military coup 10 days ago, has insisted on no more than a year. The situation is complicated by the fact that President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, who resigned and dissolved the parliament after being arrested during the coup, was already under pressure to step down by large street protests.
Well, the main question for the West African leaders is the transition period and the length of the transition period. The economic community of West African states has pushed for an interim government to take over in at least 6, 9, or maximum 12 months. Meanwhile, the junta, known as the National Committee for the Salvation of the People, has said that they would like to stay in power for up to 3 years.
Have either side signaled about how they plan to move beyond the current impasse?
Well, the West African leaders are likely to keep up pressure on the junta. So far, the junta has gone from saying they would like to stay in power 3 years. It was down to 2 years about a week ago. But the economic community of West African state is likely to accept more than half of that. We know that the junta has made some sort of effort in a gesture of goodwill. Yesterday, they released the ousted President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, signaling that they might be ready to meet some of the demands by the West African community. What we also know is that the junta is meeting with West African heads of state, have been meeting with diplomatic missions. They're communicating with people in a way that has actually put them in place as a transitional government. We also know that the Malians have largely supported the coup. There hasn't been huge amounts of violence either during the day of the coup or in the days after. A lot of Malians actually don't even see this as a coup. They see it as a popular uprising.
Is that having an impact on the negotiations? Because, as you mentioned, West African leaders want a return to civilian rule. But if the population is behind the junta who, you know, removed Keita from office, what does that do to the discussions?
Indeed, the fact that the junta has popular support from the population reinforces their position. We also know that the West African leaders, the delegation led by former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, who was in Bamako earlier this week, actually met with President Keita, who declared that what he wants for his country is peace and stability, and that he didn't wish to be reinstated. This, of course, you can debate whether he said this freely. He's been in detention with the junta for about a week and was only released yesterday. But obviously, the West African leaders' initial intentions to reinstate Keita is both been blocked by the fact that Keita doesn't want to be reinstated, and also because of the fact that population might not want him back.
International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with journalist Katarina Hoya, who's monitoring events in Mali from nearby Abidjan. Tunisia's prime minister-designate has unveiled a new cabinet dominated by independent technocrats, saying partisan tensions made a coalition government impossible. It's the country's second government in 6 months. Hichem Mechichi's decision to bypass consultations with political factions angered the powerful Islamist party Ennahdha, which has demanded a political government reflecting the balance of power in parliament. That may complicate parliamentary approval of the cabinet. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi discussed possible scenarios with Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at Carnegie's Middle East program.
Hopefully they will be. There's certainly less political pressure on a technocratic government than there is on a political government. And hopefully they'll be more willing to take risks than politicians would be able to. But this is not Tunisia's first technocratic government. They've tried this in the past. And we've seen that just because it's a technocratic government, they're not guaranteed to perform better than a government made up of political figures.
Mchiche's decision to bypass consultations with political factions had angered, among others, the powerful Islamist party Ennahdha, which has demanded a political government reflecting the balance of power in the parliament. Would that lead to a parliamentarian disapproval of the technocrat cabinet offered by Mchiche?
It is possible that certain parties, including Ennahdha, will not vote to approve Mchiche's government. But if they choose that path, they're risking losing their own seats in parliament. If this government does not pass, the next step would be for President Saïd to call for new elections. And I think many of the parliamentarians recognize that they are at risk, and therefore it's much more in their interest to vote for the government. So I do expect that we will see it pass.
So what are the priorities the new Tunisian cabinet must tackle?
The first priority is the economy. They have to deal with the economic issues that have been longstanding since before the revolution, including addressing socioeconomic disparities, marginalization, unemployment, but also the issues that have come up in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, including the healthcare system, trying to make sure the government is actually serving the needs of the people. The government also needs to address the Constitutional Court to actually approve the final members of the Constitutional Court to ensure that the transition keeps going forward and implement some of the other measures from the democratic transition, such as the decentralization process that have been languishing during the transitional government.
How about corruption?
Absolutely. Corruption is another big issue that President Saïd came in promising to address. And we saw the previous prime minister, Elias Fekhrekh, removed over allegations of corruption. So I do expect that this government will take on corruption as one of the issues it really cares about.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at Carnegie's Middle East program, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Kenya has begun a massive campaign to reclaim green spaces in major cities and towns as part of an effort to conserve forests and restore parks, especially in urban areas. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
President Uhuru Kenyatta says city dwellers have realized the benefits of urban forests and green spaces, mainly for recreation and reconnecting with nature, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic.
And in order to further foster the rebirth of Nairobi and our other urban areas and integrate Greening Kenya campaign as our new normal, I'm pleased to announce that we are launching a national campaign to mobilize citizens, business, industry, labor and civil society towards a common goal, a goal of cleaning up Kenya. The Cleaning Up Kenya campaign shall be piloted here in Nairobi City County commencing on the 1st of September this year.
Some say the move is creating jobs and helping people cope with COVID-19 restrictions. Peter Njeru, 50, used to live on the streets of Nairobi. He is now among several youths from street families who have benefited from the government-led program.
Si kama nyakati hizi vile unaona kuko. Hapa kote kulikuwa makaratasi, plastic, takataka zote. Hata imuto ungeona vile unaiona saizi.
He says this place was an eyesore. There was plastic waste everywhere, and even you couldn't recognize this river. But now, thanks to the new initiative, things have changed for the better. I'm excited that I have been a part of this transformation. I've grown trees in this park.
Tunajifunia Mepanda hizi miti.
Nairobi, one of the fastest growing cities in sub-Saharan Africa, is home to the United Nations Environment Program, or UNEP. Some say the initiative will help the Kenyan capital regain its lost glory as the green city in the sun. The city is famous among tourists for a national park, just a 15-minute drive from the city center, as well as Karura Forest, one of the world's largest urban forests. Kenyatta says the effort will aim to increase Kenya's riddling forest cover.
Green spaces improve on the quality of air in the city and expunge the toxins emitted by our environment. And that is why, as a nation, we are targeting a 10% forest cover across the entire country by the year 2020. Within Nairobi, the Michuki Park is the first attempt at pushing this green renaissance.
The World Health Organization, or WHO, says green spaces such as parks, urban forests, and wetlands represent a fundamental component of any urban ecosystem. Oxygen produced by trees filters out harmful air pollution and enhances water distribution into lakes and ponds, which moderate temperatures within the city. Clement Goriareng is the Assistant Chief Conservator of Forests at the Kenya Forest Service.
Ensuring that there are also green spaces in the cities, and work with other agencies also to make sure that we have places where the members of the public can fall to, even for recreational purposes. And therefore, Kenya Forest Service is actually the lead agency in management of the tree resources.
Environmental campaigners backed the move, pointing out that such initiatives, including better water service and waste management, will help city dwellers cope not just with the coronavirus pandemic, but with the worsening climate change effects. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. West African leaders are having another virtual meeting to convince Mali's military junta to speed up its transition to civilian rule. Tunisia has unveiled a new cabinet dominated by independent technocrats. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Opposition parties in Tanzania allege that hundreds of their candidates have been disqualified from participating in the country's October 28th general election. They have formally submitted their grievances to the National Election Commission. Benson Kigila, Secretary General of the main opposition party Chadema, says 57 of its candidates for parliament and 642 for councillor had been disqualified as of yesterday. Other opposition candidates have raised similar complaints. The director of the Electoral Commission, Dr. Wilson Mahera, says he expects to decide on each of the complaints by September 6th. The Central Bank of Zimbabwe has issued new measures to shore up dwindling foreign currency reserves and curtail what it says is illicit money dealing. Arigando gives us more on the development.
The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe says the new measures will support the foreign exchange auction system. The auctions were set up in June to secure foreign exchange for critical sectors, goods and services such as energy and imports of grain and drugs. The central bank also said the auction helps thwart the illicit parallel foreign exchange market, which it says contributes to the country's inflation rate, now at more than 700% a year. The bank said since it began allowing foreign currency pricing for goods and services while maintaining the position that the economy is based on the local RTGS dollar, foreign exchange balances had grown to US $404 million by July. That is up from US $352 million in January. Under US rules, the central bank will confiscate and liquidate 20% of the foreign currency that businesses deposit in accounts at the official auction rate so it can be used in the auctions. Economic analysts, however, say this will lead businesses to circumvent the rules. Economic analyst Professor Gift Mugano says business owners will be skeptical as many lost money in past years when monetary authorities imposed foreign currency controls. He thinks many will end up using underground means to hold on to their cash.
So there's no guarantee that in the near future, the same government will not raise the threshold, particularly when they are running dry in their foreign exchange regime, the auction system. So clearly, in my view, business deposits whatever they can in an apologetic manner to just comply with the law. But obviously, they will find means of keeping some money in their chest.
Zimbabwe has struggled with inflation, shortages of basics like fuel and some medicines, and falling production for decades. In the past few years, the country has struggled to halt the slide. It introduced the new RTGS dollar currency last year and restricted transactions in other currencies. Earlier this year, the official exchange rate was 25 RTGS to the US dollar, but in the parallel market, it traded as low as 95 to the dollar. In the most recent auction, it officially traded at 83 to the dollar. Mugano says in the past, many businesses saw the government convert U.S. dollar bank accounts to Zimbabwean dollars at a one-to-one exchange rate.
So there's been very bad experience in our banking sector. And also the same can be said with the treasury bills, which were issued by the monetary authorities to businesses and were subscribed to in U.S. dollar terms. But at the point of conversion, when we were changing over to Zimbabwean dollar last year in June 24, the debt level was $9.4 billion. It was rated at 1:1. So automatically the government converted the U.S. dollar denominated debt into Zimbabwean dollar at the loss of business. So even now, as you've seen, there was no indication that the government will pounce on the 20% of the foreign currency deposits by the businesses.
Economic analyst Prosper Chitambara applauds the narrowing of the difference in the traded value of the RTGS in the parallel market and in the auctions. However, like Mugano, he thinks the central bank will push some businesses underground with the 20% confiscation rule.
And obviously the risk there is that this could actually discourage formal sector intermediation. This could encourage people to prefer to transact in cash as opposed to using the banking system as a way of circumventing that, the liquidation of 20%.
Some economists warn that monetary measures aimed at shoring up foreign exchange reserves without addressing fundamentals such as economic policy consistency and reviving the agricultural and manufacturing sectors is not sustainable in the long run. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Harare.
Pride Afrique is the first of its kind, a three-day virtual extravaganza celebrating Africa's diverse, colorful community of sexual minorities. But behind the glitz and glam, participants say, is a very serious need to bring gay Africans into the light as their lives are threatened on the continent every single day. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Homosexuality is illegal in more than half of Africa's 54 countries, with penalties ranging from jail time to execution. Even in countries where same-sex relationships and fluid gender identities are decriminalized, they remain culturally unpopular and often result in discrimination or even targeted violence. And, as if things weren't challenging enough, the coronavirus pandemic has eliminated the ordinary daily social encounters that can break down stereotypes and foster understanding. And so, thought a small group of queer African filmmakers, writers, and artists, in these socially distant times, why not bring queer pride to everyone? That was the purpose of this year's inaugural Unusual Pride Afrique Festival. The multimedia celebration of Africa's rainbow of sexual minorities was held virtually over 3 days this month, amid restrictions across the continent that prohibit large gatherings. About 1,000 people tuned in digitally on YouTube. Festival committee member Welcome Lashiva says that while the event may look fun, sexy, and glamorous, its underlying message is very serious.
72 countries in the world criminalize homosexuality, and 32 of them are in Africa. So it is very important to have initiatives like Pride Afrique, where queer people in Africa can come together to reclaim their power, to reclaim their voice, and to reclaim their pride. Reports still show that queer people are still living difficult lives in relation to everyone else, even in South Africa.
The Shiva brought up several recent examples, including a continuing epidemic of violence against lesbians and trans women in South Africa, which was the first African country to decriminalize homosexuality. Over 3 days, dozens of participants shared their experiences of coming to terms with their gender and sexuality. Those accounts were important to festival participant Noni Salma, who spoke to VOA via Google Hangouts from her home in New York. Salma, a filmmaker, says attitudes in her native Nigeria keep her from feeling comfortable there. She is transgender, and her work has explored themes of homosexuality in Africa.
I think it's important to see African queer people being joyful because I think it's revolutionary. I think it's as important as, you know, highlighting our trauma and our pain. I mean, that's magic. I mean, I don't want to discount what that could do for queer people in Africa who are struggling and who do not see that, who do, you know, who don't even know that that's a thing. 14-year-old, 12-year-old me would have loved to see that, you know, that yes, pain exists, but also joy is something that also that we can have.
Professor Jean Nell, a psychologist and researcher at the University of South Africa, says visibility is the first step towards acceptance. Nell studies violence against sexual minorities and is lobbying South Africa's government for a new bill that will track and classify such incidents as hate crimes. He recalled South Africa's first known pride parade in 1990, before homosexuality was decriminalized. The 100 or so participants wore brown bags over their heads to conceal their identities out of fear of retribution. That's why, he says, there's so much power in unmasking and celebrating queer Africans. He says many problems stem from the notion, which he and other academics and historians dispute, that homosexuality is un-African.
In an African context, a lot of the pushback, if you want to call it, would be based on outdated colonial laws, a tendency to scapegoat during political conflicts, perhaps a religiosity that is quite evident in much of Africa. We have religious, well, rigid beliefs in cultural and family values. And then, of course, a very strong patriarchal mindset. And I would say all of those things would feed into why some people would indeed say being LGBTI is un-African.
Lashiva agrees, but added that this year's festival gave him something he badly needed in these lonely, socially distant times.
It really suddenly feels like I have a new family, and my personhood, my dignity, and my rage against homophobia, transphobia, and biphobia has been affirmed by Pride Afrique, because I know there are people out there like me. I know there are people out there like me who are beautiful, who are powerful, who have, you know, powerful thoughts about making the world a better place.
That's what matters, he says, to be proud, safe, happy, and accepted at home in Africa. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Ihayes Uhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokibil Iyabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.